You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
And today, Neil, we're kicking off season four, which I am very excited and proud to bring to our listeners. I'm sure we've got a lot of great content coming up this season that I'm really excited to share with everyone. But I want to take a moment, pause, and talk about a community cultural issue that has been much in the public conversation everywhere recently. Let's talk for a little bit about what actually happened in this instance that I think is directly affecting our listenership and the people who are part of this community. So both you and I attended NIPS this year in Long Beach. At NIPS, there was a final party for the conference, and the Imposteriors, who are a band comprised of super high-level researchers and professors, played, and the lead singer for the band is Brad Carlin, who is a professor and head of the Division of Biostatistics at the University of Minnesota. And at that party, at the end of the night, he made a joke that was in pretty poor taste. The researcher, Christiane Lum, who works a lot on problems with HR DAG, she, a couple of days after that, she had not attended NIPS. She wrote a blog post on her personal blog about the statement that he had made, and also outlined a number of instances of sexual harassment. And she published this on December 13th. And in this blog post that Ms. Lum wrote, she referred to Carlin and a person who, in her post, she called S, as having been people who were involved in several of these instances. And we later learned through some reporting from Bloomberg that S referred to Stephen Scott, who was with Google. And Carlin is now under investigation by his university. We are talking openly now about instances of sexual harassment, abuse of power within the community. And I think that it's a really important subject that deserves our attention. And one thing that I wanted to do with you today, Neil, is to talk about sort of where we are and how we can go forward, how we can use this instance to teach ourselves a valuable lesson and improve as a community and as a group of humans.
Yeah, I think, obviously there are specific allegations that are being investigated. I think probably making direct comment on those is not helpful, but stepping back and sort of having a think about how and why these sort of things can generally come about in a, well, any community, but, you know, with a focus perhaps on academia and, statistics and machine learning in general, to perhaps increase awareness of what we can do. And having said that, not saying that I'm in any form an expert doing this, but it just sort of, you can see certain systemic things that can bring these challenges about and that we should learn how to address them.
Neil, you make a very good point that we are not experts here, but I think that an important thing to do is for the community to keep discussing these things, right? Openly, because that's the only way I think that we're going to bring about change that's lasting.
Yeah, and obviously these incidents took part in part of a wider context, the Me Too campaign and what's been going on in Hollywood. I can't say I'm a big fan of everything being played out over Twitter. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the right solution to everything, but one also has to say that those open discussions that we've all become aware of are helping communities, should help. I mean, the right response is to take a look at yourself as a community and say, well, of course, there will be finger pointing and of course that's necessary and dealing with behaviors where individuals have committed it. But I don't think that my own feeling is that to step back a little and sort of say, well, okay, if incidents have happened, but somehow we we're all participating in allowing them to happen in the open, in the communities. These incidents aren't, whatever the circumstance, not just restricted to academia. They're not happening just in private. There are examples of behavior that are public examples of behavior.
Right.
So even if it's unintentional, somehow it seems we've been complicit. As a community, you know, in those behaviors.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that there are ways that you can sort of, I think, set yourself up for a community that is more used to abuses of power when you have a really hierarchical, a really well-defined hierarchical power structure. And I think in academia, you have a very well set up, entrenched hierarchical power structure, right? And so that makes it very hard to say something about someone's behavior or criticize someone even outside of the questions or issues you might be working on or your career because of the impact that person has throughout the entire structure that you may also be a part of, right? So I think that those setups make the change that much harder to affect.
Yeah, I think there's two components to that. There's the, I mean, again, my impression is that, where there are power structures, as you point out, for academia, that we're more vulnerable to these types of problems. And I think there's two parts to the reasons for that. One is that powerful people become used to certain forms of behavior around them, whether they're conscious of it or not. They have certain expectations of the way people behave towards them. And those expectations could amplify unconscious bias.
Right, right.
And I think often do. I don't think that that's necessarily people are taking sort of steps to, I mean, and this applies to whatever minority community we're talking about, but the I think that you can, if you're a powerful person, become presumptive about what you expect from people. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one side to it. And that can perhaps involve in overstepping the mark subconsciously to actually conscious abuse of that. So there's a spectrum of behaviors. Mm-hmm. And just because we as individuals aren't guilty, all of us, of the conscious transgressions, I think we can still look to ourselves on the subconscious transgressions.
Yes, definitely.
Those who are in a position of power. And of course, those who are not are in the position of finding it difficult to challenge that power. And that can be either in the form of allowing people to get away with behavior which would not be acceptable in your direct peers, but feeling intimidated to not call it out, to actually aping that behavior. I mean, actually powerful people encourage people to sort of, you know, come along with the power as part of it, to actually being a victim. So these are the bystanders to actually being a victim of behavior of the direct conscious transgressions of the power boundaries and finding it hard to sort of call that out because of the effect it may have on your career or your, you know, relationships with your colleagues or whatever else. And it strikes me that all of these things are present whenever there's power asymmetries. Now, we're lucky, where we're at an advantage, I hope, as academics, is that we should be able to take a long, hard look at this and say, well, hey, that's, you know, there's a problem there. We like tackling problems, and there's a problem where we can do some direct good rather than just writing a bunch of papers and sort of maybe
an
take
area
some
for
actions.
Application.
An application of the thinking about how we can improve behavior.
Right.
So, but these things are, I mean, I think as we, power structures are one thing, but the other thing we know is that they're quite entrenched.
Yes.
So it's not a new thing that these power structures exist in academia. And no. Actually, I often think it's kind of remarkable for the United States, which views itself as a very egalitarian society. I think that the power structures in academia are almost more embedded than say, in the UK.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Because of systems of endorsement around letter writing, which have a large effect on people's career, which I think is very entrenched in the US compared to the UK.
Yeah.
But it's sort of remarkable when you do read these particular stories. You know, I think the question in my mind is often, well, this was going on, and maybe there were hints of it going on, but how could people get away with it for so long? They're sort of taking advantage of somehow, although, you know, systemically communities turning apparently a blind eye to this behavior, because there's awareness at some level, but not at a community level.
Yeah. And I think that's a really great point. Like what, and I think is sort of the next step, and where the rest of us who are not experts and also perhaps not victims can actually play a meaningful part. Like what can we do to make this part of something that we're aware of as a community? And we were chatting about this the other day, Neil, and you had a really great trick for sort of thinking about whether or not a person's behavior is sort of outside of the lines, maybe a little bit too much, on a number of fronts, sort of with regards to abuse of power or aggressiveness or on any sort of fronts. I think you told me that you like to sort of think about what the person is doing, step back for a moment, and then switch the person's gender. And that helps you to sort of get a step back on whether or not the person is doing something that you would find acceptable for everyone, or if you're making an assumption about that behavior given who they are or what they're doing.
Yeah, I think that's something I find very helpful. I mean, as someone, so actually the time when it comes up a lot for me where I use this trick is in particular when I'm chairing meetings. So I think that there's an onus on the chair to be impartial. And I know sometimes if I get emotionally involved in a subject, emotionally, I mean, you know, as we do about ideas, passionate, perhaps emotional is the wrong word, passionate about an idea, I'm not very good necessarily at behaving in the way I want to. You know, there's these dual process models of cognition, system one and system two. System two is the thing you think you are, this rational thing, and system one is, you know, and then there's like all these analogies, system two, the human, system one, the ape, all this stuff. So you are actually the ape, and when you get passionate about something, you behave like an ape, and you... and to try and control that, I have coping mechanisms in myself, because I know my own behaviors aren't always as I would like them to be. And one of those little coping mechanisms I use is gender flipping. So I look at how I'm thinking of the person. I see someone's behavior. Sometimes I think, oh, that's unusual behavior. And then I try and flip their gender and see if I mentally still think they're... mentally, I don't actually physically try and flip their gender. And of course, one has to be careful that, you know, there's a spectrum of gender, but this is sort of at an extreme. I sort of think, like there was an example, I was in a meeting once where a very senior male professor was kind of upset with the way the meeting was going and was making all sorts of bellowing noises and sort of huffing and closing his eyes and putting his hands behind his head. And it was kind of like the right mental picture is there was sort of a large bison. Sort of, I was finding it reasonably intimidating,
right? Yeah,
and I was, you know, and of course, that starts having an effect on maybe your decision making, you know, because I'm feeling this individual was senior to me, I'm chairing the meeting, and it wasn't going their way. And then in that case, I did gender flipping, and embarrassingly, I just thought the individual looked ridiculous as a female doing this. And I was realizing I was only finding this behavior, even in any shape or form, acceptable because it was a male. It right. shows it's my unconscious bias. This sort of bellowing and snorting and stuff like this, as I'm, you know, unfortunately in society, is like accepted for a high-powered male.
Right.
But somehow right. for a female, it isn't. Right. Accepted. And I just thought, oh my God, this behavior is utterly ridiculous. I mean, well, not because I just thought it would be ridiculous in a female. I said, like, why should I be being swayed by bellowing and right. snorting? If it's not going this individual's way, they need to make some rational points.
Right.
And I'm not saying that they were using this personally, but obviously they were exhibiting a pattern of behavior that
was a little bit absurd, but they could get away with. And I love the idea that like an acceptable behavior, an acceptable it sort of for anything, for expressing yourself in any way, should be totally normal when expressed by either by someone who is presenting as any sort of gender, right?
Yeah.
So like if someone is doing something that's a little bit crazy and you shift your context just enough to be like, oh, what are my internal biases about this? And you give yourself just enough space to be like, would I think differently about this if this action was being performed by someone else? Like, that's an amazing way to get space on your own personal biases.
Yeah, I think it precisely. And it really, certainly it helps me. You know, there's other arguments that says, oh, people should just hear what people say and everything else and ignore all the other forms of behavior. You know, we are a very accepting community. So even if someone's forming abnormal behavior, you know, one perhaps shouldn't make it think in that case, that abnormal behavior that wasn't, you know, it was just probably even just a tick from the person potentially, right? But it's just, I should try and ignore it and remove it from any of my thinking. I shouldn't make me think less of the person when they make sensible points later on. I shouldn't ignore those points. But when you start thinking about that, I'd use that for chairing, and it just made me think, oh, well, I should just use this in social situations more. I should use this when standing around in a group and, you know, for my own behavior towards a student that approaches me, whether they're male or female. And if I want to sort of think, how appropriate am I being, then I should use the gender flipping to help. And even, you know, with people who aren't, you know, necessarily identifying as one gender or another, just try and put, oh, what would I think of this person if this was just some other individual? You know,
right.
You know, I think.
It's not, gender is really handy, I think, because it's sort of everyone in general, unless you are working extremely hard at being androgynous, everyone sort of presents some sort of gender to the world, right? So you can easily kind of flip that context. And it's just, it's not about the thing that you've chosen to flip, it's the flipping. It's the like the movement on the context that allows for that. And I like what you said a lot about that we should look at the behavior and sort of separate it from the person. And that I think is something that's really important when you're in a community which is highly skewed towards men, which computer science at large and machine learning sort of in general is, and also that attracts people who are not as sociable as like the marketing community or the communications community or something like that. I think if you can get to the point where if you are monitoring your behavior or your colleague's behavior, or your friend's behavior, and you feel like you need an intervention, saying something like, oh man, that joke was creepy, right? Instead of saying something like, don't be creepy. Don't you be creepy, but that joke was creepy. The thing is creepy, not the person.
Calling out the behavior rather than the person can help.
Yeah.
People are people, and actually you can't, I was actually reading some about code reviews. So code reviews are this process which many of our listeners will be familiar with, where in order to have your code incorporated in the product, then other people look at it and they pass comment. And a lot of these guidelines are very much in with what you're talking about. You know, how to do these things. Well, you can imagine that these things have done badly. I mean, I love them within my team. I love, it gives me so much. I learn so much about how to improve things. I'm not writing so much code, but reading other people's code reviews. But a lot of the guidelines around good code reviews said exactly the same thing that you just said. And you know, we could think of it in that way. I mean, if we want to sort of say, you know, code review is I'm going to ship this code and it's going to go out there in the public and affect the product.
Yeah.
And having other people sort of looking at it and sort of saying, well, you know, this use of things can lead to this problem and you might not see it now, but there's a downstream consequence you haven't understood. But the way you put that is very important. It's like, oh, you idiot, everyone knows you shouldn't do that. You know,
right.
Not a great way.
No.
You know, no one really likes being criticized, even if you're criticizing the thing that they've created.
Right.
So part of this, by the way, is also if you were on the receiving end of a query on your behavior, you know, you might feel like it's giving you a rise, but actually the first thing, well, maybe they're right. And even if they're wrong, you know, maybe there's a perception that I should be worrying about. And I guess the similarities there that, you know, so you make it impersonal. So calling out the behavior rather than, you know, saying you're a bigot or something like that.
Right. Yes. Right.
And even if they are a bigot.
Right. But I think that oftentimes that's a great tactic for when you're in a situation that's unfolding in the moment. Right. Because like everyone is probably a little bit shocked. And you need, and you might want to engage with it in the moment. And so being able to call out the behavior directly as it's unfolding, I think is going to be more potent than because if you want to give the person the benefit of the doubt that they don't understand how what they are doing could be harmful, then this is a way to do that. But if it is obviously harmful, if it is obviously criminal, you need to talk to someone who has expertise in this, but then you should also maybe talk to the person who was on the receiving end of it, because you don't want to blow up their spot. You don't want to bring them into a situation that they are not ready for or don't want to be brought into. But as a way to sort of like diffuse something or to point it out while you're there in the moment, I think that sort of thing is really the best way to go. And I love the idea of it being like a code review. It's so perfect, because you're like, oh, well, you might not want to do this because in future, cascading, here are the events that would unfold from this, or here are the ways that people are not going to be able to interact with that behavior. Here are the consequences of that.
The consequences, the downstream. It may seem small now. Like the classic, I think the only thing I did in a code review, and, you know, which is correct, what I was able to say something was a try catch where they didn't catch the specific type of error. It should have been an import error. And actually, I've suffered a downstream consequence of doing that. So I was able to comment. That's the only time I've ever really... But you know, the person who I was commenting on, I think, was a more junior engineer and just hadn't come across that. And as soon as you say it, it's like, oh my God, of course I can see that could be a nightmare to debug.
Totally, right.
And of course, but it's still important the way that it's pointed out. And I think that the other thing, and I don't necessarily think I have a good answer on this. And actually, I can't remember when we last spoke about this, whether I shared this experience of you, because it only just came to me, but it's very relevant for this. And this was in a meeting where I was a subject at a meeting. And I have to be careful about how I put the meetings. I don't really want to. The situation was something hadn't gone our way, and we were doing a review meeting. And it had been a proposal that we'd put together. We kind of not compromised the sort of sensible things when which we were aware of that we could compromise that were more likely to get the proposal funded. So when we wrote the proposal, maybe saying we were going to do something which we weren't really interested in just because it was a FOP to a community that we thought might review the proposal. And even though we knew it was the wrong thing, we thought, oh, we have to put it in there or else they'll feel slighted. So in this proposal, we decided to be really purist and sort of not do that and just say, no, we're amazing and we're going to just lay it out. And because that's the way it should be.
Right.
And actually we were sort of being criticized a bit for the, for not providing a FOP, actually. So in this review meeting, said, well, you should provide a FOP by an individual who we were going through why it wasn't funded. And I said, well, we decided that we didn't want to do that, you know, that actually the right thing to show was the top quality work and to sort of get that funded. And then the individual, I'm still staggered that they did this. They started saying, well, we all know that women should be able to dress however they like and walk in dark areas. And I'm just, and you're seeing this unfolding situation. And well, I don't even want to go on to what he said next. But, and there were women in the room. No. And there were women in the room who, in this meeting, because it was a reasonably passionate meeting, who hadn't been allowed to even comment much on the meeting. And it just unfolded it in this horrifying way that you might expect. And then there's this sort of moment where I definitely explicitly decided not to call him out on it because he was in a position of power. And I didn't, and we didn't even, you know, at that point, I felt there was still something to be retrieved from the meeting and we could get somewhere we wanted to be internally. And I didn't say anything. I just let that sit. And, you know, in the context of this, I felt annoyed afterwards. We didn't get anything out of the meeting anyway, right? but that's actually not the point. Where's my mechanism? And I know I can't stand here and say that the next time exactly the same thing happens when there's a position of power. I definitely know. I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot from when I see that sort of thing coming. I tend to call it out. Because I think even if we had got something out of me, the way I feel about not having called it out there is very, very bad. And not just because it was only one female that was present. You know, I just feel embarrassed that I didn't in front of her. It wouldn't have done anything perhaps more than reassure her that people worry about this. But, and I think that maybe is the main reason. You know, what harm did it do in some sense? It was in a private conversation. What harm did it do other than to my impression of the individual? But it must have felt very awkward to the only female researcher present.
Yeah, and I'm sure, like a number of men, it also made them feel super awkward. It made you feel super awkward. And yeah. Like, you still think about that all the time.
It's one of those cringe moments in life where, you know, but normally, unfortunately, it's me doing the cringe. Well, it is me doing the cringy thing, because the reason I sort of cringe is that I didn't say anything. Mm. But, and I don't know. So whereas I have some mechanisms for sort of helping me identify when I'm dispassionate, in that situation, I was passionate about what we were talking about because I felt indignant, as we often all do, you know, whether we're right or wrong, about when our personal grant has been declined. And I guess retrospectively looking at it, I wasn't able to pull myself out of that indignancy and do the right thing, which is to sort of in a calm manner without using it against, because obviously, you know, without then using it as a scoring point, because there's another right. thing that could have gone wrong.
Right.
Like I sort of say, aha, got you. You made a, you were sexist. Now I win. That's not going to help as well. I mean,
Before doing podcasts, before coming to Talking Machines, I worked in the world of news. I spent some time at WBUR, which, is now having a very large internal investigation around abuse of power and some sexual harassment. And that sort of talk is not uncommon in newsroom meetings. And I find that once you like get to that level, you're not going to get a whole lot more out of that meeting. Whatever you wanted to salvage is just like it. And so I have found that, And you're so right about like not using this as a way to like score a point or even be perceived as like scoring a point or like stopping, you know, like, well, I win now because we have to stop the conversation because you're being ridiculous, right? But you get to that point I used to call it the live to fight another day plan, which may not be the greatest title for it. But when we get to that point in a meeting, I used to say, if I had any sort of power over how the meeting was going, I said, you know, I don't think we're going to be able to get anywhere else about the topics that we need to resolve today. So let's reschedule, right? And that sort of like puts a chill on the ridiculous thing that was just said, and allows me to gather space and time around probably feeling pretty enraged around the ridiculous thing that was just said, and also gives me another chance to like come back and actually get the things done that I need to get done. And also gives you space to maybe talk to that person in private about the ridiculous thing that they just said. But those are so hard, especially if you don't have control over the meeting, but you're required to be there. Oh man, those situations are so difficult.
Yeah, I really like the thing you just said about diffusing the situation by revisiting. It's rare, as we kind of know, unfortunately, say in the political landscape, which is so divided now. It's rare that a new consensus is arrived at when the quality of debate is low.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying is that which I hadn't really thought of, but in retrospect, I think you're absolutely right, that was just a massive indicator that the quality of the debate we were having was pretty low. I mean, it had got just lower, but it kind of, you know, it wasn't like that it was all just going fine and, you know, we were just about to reach a conclusion and then that was said. It was still pretty shocking when he said it, but
when people pull that stuff out, yeah, it's like a sinking ship. People don't pull that stuff out when everything's going fine. That's a weird lifeboat when you're reaching for something like that.
One thing that I've started thinking, we're sort of experiencing the communal cringe moment,
right?
And communally, we could either say to ourselves, "Ooh, let's not think about that in the way
right.
we do about embarrassing
That's
things."
Fine. That's
did.
Fine. That's fine.
Or yeah. we could look at our communal cringe moment and say, "Well, what is it about our general behavior that enabled this?" You know. When we're on the cringe moment, it's really, we sort of really overstep, but presumably we did other things getting close to the cringe moment before and kind of got away with it, you know. But and it is that there's lots of things I think that, you know, we're not individually empowered to address, but I think we are individually empowered to address that.
Right. Yeah. I think if you are not personally involved in the situation as someone who has acted or someone who is the victim of an action, or you are the expert in resolving that situation in some way, whether it be professionally in HR or emotionally as a therapist, you don't have any action to take in a specific situation. But the action that we do all have that we can take is to think about our own behaviors and to try to create positive change in a way that is effective and helpful for those around us.
And let's be clear, I think that applies not just in this case where we had to have the cringe moment.
Yeah.
Before people started talking about it as a community, but about a lot of stuff, and not just around sexual discrimination, but racial discrimination, or just, you know, prejudging people on the basis of appearances. I hope that we're quite good at a lot of these things, actually. You know, there's a lot of interesting, there's a diversity of appearances in NIPS attendees. And, you know, I always certainly try and speak to people with an open mind. And I think a lot of my colleagues do. But this applies to a number of areas, I think.
Oh, yeah. I think this applies. I think this is a golden rule that you can apply to not only your professional work, but like the way you live your life. And I think that it is extremely important for this community because members of this community are creating the tools that are going to have such a profound impact on hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of lives, right? And if we don't take a moment to think about how we act, it's much harder to think objectively about the choices we make. And, you know, if those choices are getting codified into strong tools and machines, then that has an amazing impact. This is not a problem that you solve. This is a way that we must grow and change. as a community, as a group.
Yeah, and the community is sort of self-defining, you know, and so it's a community problem as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's it for us on this episode of Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
Tune in next episode.